The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday, February the 29th. Today, foreign websites are under fire from the British Army after it emerged that Prince Harry has been with UK troops in Afghanistan, fighting who he apparently calls Terry Taliban. The standards of education of England's primary school children is suffering, according to a report today, because of too many tests and government interference in the classroom.
The NHC has been very active in bringing this to the attention of the government, and we produced a book which has been widely circulated saying just that.
Also today, African leaders have hailed President Nicolas Sarkozy's announcement to review France's military operations on the continent. And as countries around the world crack down on the use of environmentally unfriendly plastic bags, the British government has been distributing about 1 million of them.
In the last year, the government's given out free nearly 1 million single-use plastic bags branded with the names of various of their departments.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But without further ado, today's headlines and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Prince Harry has been fighting the Taliban on the front line in Afghanistan, the Ministry of Defence has confirmed. He spent the last 10 weeks serving in Helmand province. The deployment was subject to a news blackout deal, which broke down after being leaked by foreign media. The British military are deciding whether Prince Harry should leave Afghanistan. We'll have more on that in just a moment. A new review says the government should increase primary school budgets to match those in secondary schools to tackle literacy. There's currently a 20% funding gap between primary and secondary schools. More on this in Guardian Daily. Shackles were found yesterday in one of the underground chambers, found hidden under two concrete floors at the Jersey care home. Police sources said the find was significant and that it matched accounts given by many of the victims who said they'd been sexually and physically abused while in solitary confinement in punishment rooms underneath Haut de la Garenne. Forensic teams continue their searches today. Former media tycoon Conrad Black has lost a final attempt to delay the start of his 6.5-year jail term. Three appeal judges said Black had failed to raise any substantial issues of doubt over two of his four criminal convictions. He'll present on Monday to prison to begin his 6.5-year sentence. Kenya's rival leaders have signed a power-sharing deal mediated by Kofi Annan to end the country's post-election crisis. The deal will see the opposition leader Raila Odinga occupy a newly created post of executive prime minister. More details on this later in Guardian Daily. There's almost blanket coverage of Prince Harry's deployment to Afghanistan in this morning's papers. Headlines include Harry the Secret Hero from the Daily Express, When Harry Met Tally from the Daily Star, and This Is About As Normal As I'm Ever Going to Get from the Times. The Guardian gives the story a political twist, reporting that America's top intelligence official has admitted that Afghanistan's mission is close to failing. The Mail continues its plastic bag campaign with an interview with the Prime Minister, who says that we should aim to eliminate the single use plastic bag altogether. And The Independent leads with a new education report claiming that political interference has stopped our teachers teaching. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Prince Harry has secretly been serving in Afghanistan with British troops since December. But how much of a secret was it? A highly unusual news blackout has been observed by the British media. News organisations knew about it, but kept the story from the public. Media Guardian's Mark Sweeney explains how the story broke last night.
There's quite a tale to it. A US news aggregation site called The Judge Report put up a story about it, which sent pretty much everyone else to cover different pieces on it. However, it appears that the British media were part of a large-scale media blackout that was agreed with the Ministry of Defence.
And this was to protect the security, not just of Prince Harry, but his colleagues fighting in Afghanistan.
Well, that was the whole point. Harry has harboured desires to go and serve, and he was denied last year to go out to Iraq over fears for his safety and also the safety of the men around him. So what the MOD did was round up a kind of an agreement with various media sources to agree a kind of a bizarre embargo that no one would write anything until he returned in the end of April.
Is there any precedent for this sort of thing?
In terms of precedent, it's hard to say, but it is rather bizarre, particularly given the multimedia nature that we now live in, with blogs and websites everywhere. It seems amazing that the story hasn't got out until now. In fact, the Ministry of Defence was saying last night on the news services that they were quite angry that the story had come out, but we do know, in fact, that they're rather surprised that it hasn't come out before now. In fact, it transpires that an Australian women's magazine, of all places, broke with the story earlier in January, on January the 15th, but it appears to have either gone unnoticed, or perhaps the British media decided not to write anything until the much bigger coverage Drudge Report covered it.
And the head of the British Army, rare praise for the British media.
Yeah, rare praise. Some of the details that have emerged from these meetings that the media had, which included news and newspaper sources, were really quite bizarre in terms of compliance. There was all sorts of agreements about a series of embeds with Prince Harry, shots of him being really candid. Apparently he's participated in a number of calling in of airstrikes, and this footage was going to be pulled and divided up amongst various newspapers to such an extent that his timing coming home was going to suit the media. It was mooted that he would come back on a Friday so that daily newspapers, weekend newspapers, news, TV news and evening papers would all be able to get a slice in time for them to best be covered, to be able to cover the story.
Well, yesterday the embargo was finally broken. What happened after that?
At a series of meetings that the Ministry of Defence had with the British media, it was agreed that if there was a break of the embargo, that Harry would be brought home. He would be brought home early, and that would be of concerns over safety. There also appears to have been discussions about what happens if such an incident as happened last night with the story breaking overseas happens, what the British media would do. That agreement was to delay covering the story as much as is possible to give potentially time for forces out in Afghanistan to move Harry to a safer location. Obviously, the story has run about rather rapidly, so I don't know what they'll make of that.
In English primary schools, educational standards have fallen since Labour came to power, according to research published today. Cambridge University academics say it's because pupils are spending too much time preparing for tests. Schools are still not getting enough money, and there's been too much meddling by the government in the way school children are taught. The government's rejected the criticism, but Mick Brooks is General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, which represents mainly primary schools.
Nobody in my association, and certainly our primary members, nobody is saying that money should be taken out of the secondary sector and transferred into the primary sector. We have no evidence of secondary schools that are overfunded. And secondly, that there are very expensive items such as exam fees that secondary schools have to pay for.
These academics have said that children are spending too much of their time, especially in primary schools, preparing for tests in English and maths, meaning that other elements of education, which are important, are suffering as a result. Is that your experience?
Yes, the NHT has been very active in bringing this to the attention of the government, and we had a commission on assessment and testing and produced a book which has been widely circulated saying just that. So we're pleased that the primary team have come up with the same findings. We know that year six for many primary children is largely ruined because they're spending an awful lot of their time rehearsing for really a quite meaningless test, which, unlike GCSEs and A-levels, is about 4 years of their work and is very short. Now, we're certainly not asking for a longer test, but it really isn't a very good assessment, we don't think, of children's aptitudes. And we should be looking at trusting teacher assessment more, and there should be a bank of tests, such as the Scottish system, a bank of tests that schools can draw on when it's right for them to accredit that teacher assessment to make sure that it's as accurate as possible.
The primary review today says that since 1997, the government's interfered much more in what's going on in the classroom. But isn't it always going to be a drawback that politicians will want to influence the national curriculum?
Getting involved in education is something that we expect politicians to do, but micromanagement of education, and indeed what happens in the classroom, is killing it off for some people. We know that we have a lot of our heads, particularly primary heads, who are just fed up to the back teeth with being told what to do, when to do it, and how to do it, and then being inspected quite aggressively at times on whether they have succeeded in that, and they're simply throwing up their hands and saying somebody else can do this job, and they're walking. Now, that's not good for the profession. It's certainly not good for making sure that we have sustainability in leadership when we know that 50% of heads will be leaving the profession over the next 4 or 5 years. So, I think Rob Alexander makes a very good point here.
The General Secretary of the National Association of Head Teachers, Mick Brooks. And there's more on that story at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website today, A&R men and women. They're the people who discover new artists, sign them up and then bring out the best in their talent. John Harris says today that EMI's decision to fire its A&R staff could hammer the final nail in the company's coffin. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment. Is free. Michael Bloomberg says he won't run for president. The independent New York mayor says he may endorse one of the party candidates. More on that at guardian.co.uk/America. And on our food blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/food, The Observer's restaurant critic Jay Rayner on the etiquette of the doggy bag, a minefield. Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, is touring Africa. Speaking to the South African Parliament yesterday, he said France was going to renegotiate all its agreements on defence with African countries. Julian Borgia is The Guardian's diplomatic editor.
Well, he said it's time to start again with French-African relationships, starting on the security side. He said he's going to renegotiate every defence agreement that France has had with African states, mostly post-colonial, post-French colonial states, and base them on underpinning more fitting to the 21st century, to the 20th. In other words, of the end of the old mission civilatrice of France that was really lasted from the period of De Gaulle, where the French relations with former French colonies was a sort of patron-client relationship. What he's saying is that will no longer hold.
How many troops has France got in Africa?
About 9,000 spread around the old French colonies, Chad, Central African Republic, Djibouti is one of the biggest one, Abidjan. And he made clear that those numbers are going to be reviewed. French officials are saying there may be some closures of some bases. And the focus of French defense cooperation will now be with the African Union, helping set up a stronger African Union force. An African Union force has been deployed in Darfur for some time, several years, but without proper equipment and with very few trained troops. And so both Britain and France now are focusing their efforts on a collective African force rather than dealing with their post-colonial client governments.
How will this be received in Africa?
Well, Thabo Mbeki has already said that this is a break from post-colonialism. It is really the most outdated relationship between the former colonial powers and their former colonies, because really these agreements have remained unchanged since 1960. And Sarkozy drew attention to this and saying that there was no way that the agreements drawn up in 1960 is still relevant today. So it's a real break with the past.
France is one of the main contributors to the European Union's efforts to protect refugees in Chad. You mentioned Chad. But what more could the France and the EU do to bring peace to the region?
Well, I think the focus now will be on the African Union. There's this feeling that as a continent, Africa will now be the primary source of sort of its own collective responsibility. And there's a lot of effort now, increasing amount of money and training going into this African Union force that we've seen deployed in Darfur. It'll be less bilateral, more multilateral.
Now, Julian, there's another story that I'd like to ask you about, if I may, and that's the political deal in Kenya to end the violence that we've seen since the disputed election in December. What are the terms of this deal?
Well, the terms are that President Kibaki allows the creation of a new post of prime minister, and that post will be filled by his bitter rival, the opposition leader, Raila Odinga. And so power in Kenya will be split for the first time, really, since independence. And there will be a divvying up of cabinet roles, with most of the domestic responsibilities going to Odinga, and the presidential foreign affairs and defense portfolios still remaining under the presidency. So they've really cut the executive power in two and shared it.
How much of a coup was this for Kofi Annan?
That's enormously important. If this holds, this is a really important diplomatic success for Kofi Annan, because if it had failed, there were clearly forces on both sides, opposition and government, who are ready to go back to war in the around the Rift Valley and across Kenya. It could have been a bloodbath.
That's Julian Borger. It's John Dennis with Guardian Daily. Still to come, Russia elects a new president on Sunday, but the era of Vladimir Putin may not quite be at an end. And a new exhibition shines a light into the darkest corners of underground London.
You're not asthmatic, epileptic, hypoglycemic, or prone to fits, fainting, blackouts, anything like that, are you?
No.
But first, nearly a million non-biodegradable plastic bags were handed out last year by the British government. At the same time, it was calling on businesses to stop using them because of the damage plastic bags do to the environment. The Guardian's Allegra Stratton has the details.
In the last year, the government's given out free nearly 1 million single-use plastic bags branded with the names of various of their departments. This includes the Home Office, the Foreign Office, the Electoral Commission, which is publicly funded. It's not a government department, but it's publicly funded. It's taxpayers' money. It also includes the Department for Work and Pensions. In that particular department, it's the Health and Safety Executive that gave out 600,000 plastic bags.
And what have these plastic bags been used for?
Well, they're used for promotional campaigns. So, for instance, the DVLA said that it was for exhibitions and campaigns. Another one said that it was for use in their fire kills campaigns. And the minister, when they're responding to the question in Parliament, the minister actually said, well, this has helped reduce the number of deaths from fires.
What's the government said about this?
A Cabinet Office spokesman, that's the office that oversees, supposed to oversee all departments. They say there's no specific guidelines, but there are targets for reducing carbon emissions, and clearly plastic bags come under that.
What's the government's official position on plastic bags?
I mean, the thing is, in May of last year, it had a waste strategy that it put out where it said we want to try and phase the use of plastic bags out. Bear in mind, this is at the same time as all these free plastic bags are being handed out. November of last year, Brown used his first speech on the environment, first speech as a prime minister, to say that he wants to go further than that. He wants to completely get rid of them as quickly as possible. The thing that actually is going through Parliament is something that was initiated by London councils. They got this, 33 councils in London, they got together, they found out that most Londoners did want some kind of ban on plastic bags, and they're able to pilot a private bill through Parliament, and they've chosen to do this on plastic bags. And I've just spoken to them, and they expect that to be debated by MPs in April.
And Marks & Spencer, meanwhile, this week has announced it's going to charge its customers 5p for a plastic carrier bag. Will other retailers now follow suit?
I mean, there's two schools of thought. The one in Ireland is that you have this, effectively, this tax on them. That's what the government doesn't like. The government would prefer to just completely ban them, to just not have them available. And that's what happened in France. And in France, you've seen the use of plastic bags go down by half. So I think that actually the government's probably erring not on the side of M&S's strategy. Possibly. I think it's more looking at just that you just won't find them in shops.
And meanwhile, the Daily Mail this week, of all newspapers, launches a campaign to ban plastic bags. And it's unlikely that the Daily Mail would start a campaign like this. And we're looking at, you know, splashed over pages 1 to 7 every day, unless it was sure it was going to win.
Yeah, but I think the Mail's doing it because it's sort of, you know, oldie England, look after the environment. That's why it's doing it, rather than sort of, I think it's quite coherent with the Mail's position on stuff. But I think the move by London councils to have it voted on in April, that when they did that, when they said, right, our private bill will be on this, the London councils were the ones that started the smoking ban. That's how smoking ban legislation started. So as soon as you heard that, it was quite clear that there was momentum behind it.
The Guardian.
In today's Football Weekly Extra, paintball days out with England's John Terry. No wonder Frank Rijkaard fancies joining Chelsea. But is the Barca master really headed to the bridge? And why has Roman Abramovich booked every top eatery in Moscow for May the 21st? We look back at the midweek FA Cup action, Sheffield United's Paddy Kenny, and probably the biggest howler since Digby the giant dog got neutered. There's news from Sid Lowe in Spain and from Italy too, and we preview the weekend Premier League action. That's all in Football Weekly Extra, as usual, as packed with content as in need of a good kicking as the football that gives our sport its name. For more details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
Dmitry Medvedev's election on Sunday as the Russian president is expected to be a shoo-in. Vladimir Putin is likely to become prime minister under Medvedev before a possible return to the presidency in 2012. The Guardian's correspondent in Moscow, Luke Harding, told me what Putin's saying in a speech today on Russian television.
Well, Vladimir Putin is going to very strongly urge all Russian citizens to vote in Sunday's election. He's not actually going to say explicitly they should vote for Dmitry Medvedev, the man he's already said should have the job. But I think it's fairly clear where his sympathies lie. And the problem is, of course, with this election is that there's no real competition and really a kind of mood of apathy, I think, among ordinary Russians. But at the same time, the election officials here are predicting that about 70% of the country will vote.
How has the Kremlin gone about fixing this election?
It's done it in several ways. It's basically repeated the rather subtle and sometimes less subtle tactics it used in the parliamentary elections last December. First of all, it's coerced millions of public sector workers to vote, teachers, kindergarten, workers, anyone who has an official job or an official salary. Many of them have been told to vote at work and to take absentee ballots, which are easier to supervise. And also other people I've talked to, analysts and diplomats, have been saying that the Kremlin, or at least regional officials, are planning to stuff ballot boxes again when polls close, the reason being to try and boost the turnout, which I think in real terms will be somewhere between 25 and 50%. But the Kremlin says it wants 70% of Russians to vote, and I'm sure that's the figure it will get at the end of the day.
Vladimir Putin's been Russia's president since 1999. Has there been much reflection and looking back over the Putin era in Russia?
Yes, there has. Last month at a press conference where I sat in the front row, Putin said he was asked whether, he made any mistakes or, anything had gone wrong in his era, and he basically said no. I think what Putin and his supporters would claim is that he's done several good things for Russia. He's brought back political stability after the kind of chaos of the 90s and the Boris Yeltsin era, that he's imposed peace in Chechnya and the North Caucasus, and that he's sort of presided over a period of sustained economic growth and rising prosperity. I think what's interesting, in my opinion, is that to all of those claims, that there's less of them than meets the eye. I mean, Putin's been very lucky in that oil prices have gone up from $15 or $20 a barrel to $100 a barrel. And the stability he's imposed has been really at the expense of unravelling all of the benefits of democracy and perestroika that we saw in Russia in the early 90s. And what he's done, I think rather cleverly, is he's sort of turned Russia into a kind of modern, contemporary, authoritarian state in which democracy has more or less kind of died out.
And in some ways, it's a bit early to talk about Putin's legacy because we're not sure how much power he'll retain under President Medvedev.
Yes, this is almost more interesting than the election is. What will Putin do? Will he become prime minister in May when he has to step down? He's intimated that he will do, although some people I've spoken to still don't believe that he will. What will be the relationship between Putin and Medvedev? Certainly, I think anyone who expects a change in foreign policy of Russia's sort of hawkish position towards the West under President Medvedev will be disappointed. I think that the differences between Putin and Medvedev are stylistic. Substantively, that they are the same. And of course, Putin is still around, he's still in play, and he may well decide to come back as president in 2012.
Luke Harding in Moscow.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
It's easy to forget as you walk down the street in a city such as London what's going on under your feet. But for centuries, we've needed to build almost as many tunnels to keep the city going as we have buildings. Well, now a new exhibition called Underground, London's Hidden Infrastructure, aims to expose the inner workings of the subterranean city. Matthew Weaver reports for Guardian Daily.
I'm here with Andrew Schoons, the director of the centre, who's going to give us a tour. Andrew, what's it about?
The exhibition is about the hidden world of London, both historical but also looking to the future and the important developments that are happening here. and really hopes to expose those things which people may be aware of, but they've never really seen and or understand how they work. And it's a lovely way of looking into a hidden world and exploring what's under your feet.
Right, now we're at the centre now, and the organisers are just putting the final touches to the show. Lots of wires and papers all over the place. Where does it start?
Well, we start with a bit of history and just look back into the hidden world that some of it's a long way under the ground. But, for example, we've got a piece of the Roman Wall of London, which was discovered in a recent building works in the city.
Now, the centrepiece of this show is this wonderful model of what lies beneath King's Cross and St Pancras. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, you only have to look at the tube map to realise that there's a lot of underground railways that are passing underneath or through King's Cross, and you can see that they're all picked out in the different colours here. And add to that the...
Just describe what we can see.
Well, we've got a model, and above ground you can clearly see St Pancras Station, King's Cross Station, the new arrival places for the High Speed 1, which is another fantastic piece of underground engineering which has linked London to Paris. And with the arrival of the new link to the High Speed 1 to Paris, the number of people going through King's Cross in a day is set to nearly double.
So, Ian, what are the challenges? What things can we do differently in the future when it comes to digging underground?
Well, I think, obviously, the major challenge, because underground is all about really sustainability, from the days when we put in the sewers to upgrades and improve public health to what's happening now to make the city more sustainable. And it's things like using the ground for energy, so they're storing energy and they're using it to cool buildings, reduce the amount of energy that we consume in the city.
To really get a feel for underworld London, I've taken the tube to the northwest suburb of Dollis Hill, where I'm hoping to go down a secret bunker used by the government during World War II. I've been told to wear a jumper and bring a torch. I'm meeting a man called Andrew Smith, a member of something called Subterranea Britannica. It's a kind of fan club for vaults, tunnels and sewers. Apparently he's 6'6" and he's got the keys.
Okay, so before we go down, no eating, no drinking, no smoking, obviously. You're not asthmatic, epileptic, hypoglycemic, or prone to fits, fainting, blackouts, anything like that, are you?
No.
That's good news, because it's much more difficult to get you out when you're two floors down on Dollis Hill than it is if you collapse whilst you're up on the pavement. Okay. Let's go in. I've brought the keys with me. And this anonymous steel door, yep. Well, this is it. This is the entrance. And you wouldn't have thought that Churchill's secret bunker was packed away here underneath a bit of Dollis Hill. So in we go.
Mind your head, it says.
Yeah, mind your head, mind the steps. Just shut this. Switch the torch off.
We're in complete darkness now.
Yeah, the absolute pitch black here. We don't have any lighting at the moment. But what we'll do is we'll come downstairs. So this is a two-level bunker underground. Do watch your footing on the stairs. It's just these bare concrete stairs here. And these are the very stairs that Winston Churchill came down on October 3rd, 1940, when he came here for a meeting of the War Cabinet. We're actually inside the bunker where we just walked through. You can see the remains of this old gas-type door here.
You've really got to know your way around.
Yeah, I can find my way out here, you know, without any lights. I've been here so many times. But it can appear a bit intimidating, I suppose, to go left here. Back at the steel door where we came in. Unlock the door. And there we are, daylight.
Civilization.
Yes.
Okay.
Matthew Weaver reporting. And you can see the exhibition, Underground, London's Hidden Infrastructure, at the Building Centre at 26 Store Street in central London. Full details at buildingcentre.co.uk. Thanks for listening to today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Our producers were Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.